Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast in search of a tagline. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanagieser. David, has it really been two episodes now?
Yes, we are in our second episode. It feels just like we started this yesterday.
I know. I was listening to the first episode, and I couldn't get over just how different we sounded then. And you were always asking if we wanted to go out for frosty chocolate milkshakes, and... You know, and the art style just hadn't really clicked yet, and we had no celebrity guest voices. Ugh.
Yeah, and like I said, I was saying basically a lot all throughout. That one's actually true, folks. You can go back and listen for sure. I'm pretty sure if you count it, you will get to at least 26.
So for those of you playing along at home, see what's greater in the course of an episode. Number of times that David says basically, or I say, you know.
Yes, so
we will be work pleasantly on it, surprised.
Folks. Yes.
Yeah, so what brings us back into the car for another Films Trip this week, David?
Well, as a reminder to our newfound listeners who are listening to this, each episode of Film Strips, it talks about one film in particular, but it must connect back to the film that preceded it. So, last week we talked about One from the Heart, and this week we're following Raul Julia, which we discussed this beforehand, and we're going to go with that pronunciation of his name. Hopefully we're correct on that.
It sounds nice and dignified. We apologize. Friend of the show, the estate of Raul Julia.
But yes, we're going to be taking a look at the 1985 film Kiss of the Spider-Woman, which I got to say, Andrew, I was really excited to read all those West Coast Avenger and Forcework comics in preparation.
Oh, you stole my joke!
Dude, I had no idea.
Dave, you're thinking of your old podcast.
Dang it.
Oh, that's all right. I think you made it actually far more clever. I wouldn't have thought to drop in West Coast Avengers.
Well, I know the original Spider-Woman is the more popular one, but Julia Carpenter was the first one I was ever exposed to, so that's the one that I always go back to in my head.
The classic image of the guy at the wrestling conversation. It's still real to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Like what you like, folks. But for this week, you're going to like what we like. And in this case, Kiss of the Spider-Woman. So, yeah, Dave, at the end of last episode, Dave was kind and very trusting and allowed me to take the wheel on this one. And, yeah, so we are going to 1985 with Hector Babenco's Kiss of the Spider-Woman. The film is adapted from the 1976 eponymous novel. Now, here's something else we've talked about. We're going to go with Manuel Puig.
Yeah, I believe that's... I'm hoping that's the correct pronunciation. But yeah, it's a novel originally published in Spain, 1976. Eventually, I believe 1978 or 1979 is the first English version of the book that was released. I don't know if there are multiple translations or not. I just know that the version I have here was translated by Thomas Colchi. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that name correctly. So if anybody's wondering if there, happen to reference anything that seems slightly off, that might be a factor. I should also note up front, I almost finished the whole novel. I had the last 100 pages still to read, though. I wasn't able to fit them in before our deadline. So do take some of what I say about the book with a grain of salt.
Well, David and I are both graduates from English literature and film studies. So believe us when we say, watch the movie, you'll save a whole lot of time.
Yes. Unless you happen to be, doing this for coursework. So, you might want to read the original text. But
well,
I digress.
That being said, I think it takes people all of 5 minutes to realize that no, listening to our podcast will not accredit you in any degree program. But hey, yes. No harm in trying. So Kiss of the Spider-Woman. I chose this as our film for the week. There's the obvious connection because Raul Julia appears as Ray in One from the Heart. And, you know, he's a handsome cat gone well before his time, considering how he is the most charming man to ever appear in cinema. But also, I think a lot of people, more casual filmgoers, they might know him from The Addams Family. They might know him from Street Fighter, and that is not really emblematic of all the things that Raul Julia could do. More importantly, Kiss of the Spider-Woman is... I think it kind of fits in thematically with One from the Heart, not just because they're films that deal with realism versus idealism, and sort of the real life versus the life of fantasy, but also they're kind of films that have fallen by the wayside a little bit. And that feels odd to say because, you know, Kiss of the Spider-Woman, spoiler alert, but William Hurt did win Best Actor at the Academy Awards in 1985 for this film. It's still regarded pretty highly from certain critical circles, but it also seems like this is a film that kind of... it's almost like they locked it up in a cell and we all just kind of forgot it was there.
It's hard to get your hands on a copy of this thing. I don't think it's been released on Blu-ray in North America as of yet. I don't think it's available on any streaming site service that I have seen so far. So you basically kind of had to be like me and luck out on getting your hands on the DVD copy from like the mid-2000s years ago in order to have a shot at seeing this. Or find an alternative online source that we are not necessarily encouraging people to do, but we're not encouraging you to do it either.
Well, let's just say that you can find a lot of things on the internet in a lot of different ways.
Exactly.
Oh, wait, they can't see us winking.
Dang it.
So I guess my question to you, Dave, other than the fact that it's kind of obscure and it's the film I picked, what was your working knowledge of Kiss of the Spider-Woman before we took a look at it?
Well, I had seen the film before. Like, I did watch this back in the mid-2000s when I did get my hands... stumbled upon the DVD, is what I really should say, because I found this, of all places, I do remember, at a Giant Tiger. And if you're not Canadian, you might wonder what the heck that is, but it is basically a... how would you describe it? It's not quite a department store, but it's more basically a bargain.
It splits the difference between a consignment store and a department store. So you can find a lot of things that are off-brand and generic all under one roof. And they usually have about four or five overflowing bins of DVDs and old Wii games that you can buy for like $4 a piece.
Yeah, and most of the time, you'll find stuff like the worst romantic comedies of the mid-2000s, and other times, you find an independent 1985 film about the boundary-challenging relationship between two prisoners in a, at least as far as I think the film's concerned, unnamed South American country.
It's kind of got all the trappings of Latin America. I don't believe they ever specify where it is. I believe Manuel Puig himself was Argentinian by birth, and I feel like Hector Babenco, the film's director, was also born in Argentina, but I feel like he spent most of his living in Brazil. The film itself is a Brazilian-American co-production with a largely Latin cast.
Yeah, the novel is explicitly in the Argentine Republic, as it's referred to within it. So, the film just, it's more nebulous, but you can, it's very clear what it's meant to be representative of.
Yeah, because also for those reading the newspapers in the 1980s, this is also at a time where there's great upheaval across Latin America, which isn't to say that, you know, prior to 1985, it wasn't happening. But specifically through the 80s with Ronald Reagan and his two terms in office, this is sort of a period where America as global policeman, post-Vietnam, starts being a much less, uncritically consumed thing. And especially for those who do read their history or read about, CIA involvement around the world and things, there's a great deal written about U.S. diplomatic and military efforts in regions like Brazil, in Latin America, El Salvador, the Sandinistas. All of this gets grouped in together. So even though the novel itself is written in 1976, 10 years apart means they're kind of approaching a similar problem from different lenses. I mean, that isn't to position this film as an explicitly political work, but given its production context and the time that it's made, and even the narrative of the film itself, it's hard to subtract politics entirely.
Yeah, no, it is a very political film. I don't think there's a way to get around it, but it's not political in the sense of here is the issue. It's not an issue movie in the sense that you might think about it like that. Certainly not within the Hollywood conceptualization of what a political movie is, i.e., your Tom Clancy thrillers and others, which notably would address some of what we've discussed here as well.
But it's also
Looking at
not political in the sense of, say, Lady or a Godard. There's never a point where a character just stares at the camera and reads a monologue for 50 minutes on, why we need to return to collectivism or anything like that.
Yeah, no, in fact, I would almost argue that this is a film about. Yeah, I mean, when you boil it down, it's a film about political people and apolitical people, as it were. That's a bit reductive, but I think it does sort of center it nice and it targets it well in terms of what the film's more or less addressing.
I think actually, yeah, that probably is the most apt way to summarize the film because, I mean, I don't want to constantly keep referring back to One from the Heart, but in watching it after we had decided on, there's a number of just weird little resonances, and in some respects, I feel like Kiss of the Spider-Woman achieves what One from the Heart fails to, in that it's we have what, in terms of plot, is a small film. And as you said, David, the film largely focuses on conversations in a jail cell between a political prisoner and between a man who chooses, or a seemingly a man, shall we say, who chooses to remain apolitical in matters. The two of them talk, they usually argue, but they eventually start bonding over the one prisoner's recollection of films that he's seen. So, I guess do we want to start with the novel, David? Because you read it in the last week, and I did not. So, is there anything about the novel itself that you think would inform our analysis?
It's a bit tricky because I think the novel is, how do you put this? I would say this. Actually, I think it's better if we come back to the novel later because the thing about it is, I think what's interesting about the novel and versus the film is they are very similar in many, many ways. It ends up being more structural issues that differs in terms of how it's presented, and certainly in the way in which Puig, again, apologies if I mispronounce it, chooses to basically offer the narrative because it's not a conventional novel in the sense of here is our narration and taking us all the way through, and then the characters go, and then this character said this, or this character said this, or as a recollection of a first-person narrative. The bulk of it is just it literally is a conversation. All you're seeing is the back and forth dialogue with no other real context, except for moments when you briefly see a transcript of the prisoners' profiles that have been compiled by the prison, and occasionally when you go into sort of stream of consciousness dreams that run for pages and pages at a time. But for the most part, yeah, it's just conversations.
Because that's my understanding that the formal presentation of the novel is that, yeah, it's just, is it hyphens indicate a change in speaker?
Basically, you will see just sort of a hyphen at the start of each character speaking, breaking through. And occasionally, for example, when a certain character gets ill, what you'll notice is as one character is speaking, suddenly the text will be italicized and just completely run into a hallucination or dream sequence that the one character is expecting, and then just come right back out of it. And all the only thing it's indicating is the shift in italicized to non-italicized font throughout it. And there's quite a bit of playful stuff going on in the book that way. There's likewise the only other major break, and something it's not replicated in the film and is for the better, is there are a number of footnotes throughout.
Footnotes?
Basically what they are providing is... part of it, and it's one of those things I'm glad is gone, it provides a great deal of psychoanalytic theories and other types of theories as it relates to the subject of homosexuality throughout it. So you see references to Freud and other individuals who have written on the subject and trying to contextualize it. And apparently this at first I thought that maybe this was something that was added for the English language translation, but no, apparently these were part of the original text, and they are awkwardly placed, and I honestly don't think they add anything to the text.
Trying to pathologize and sort of psychoanalytically regard homosexuality is going to be very different between 1976 and 2018.
Yeah.
But I guess sort of, not to cut you off there, but I think that difference in time and compared to differences in social attitudes over time, that leads me with one of, the more interesting aspects of the film, where there is this incredible tension between being very regressive in certain respects, but also very progressive in others. So I guess to sort of steer this off, it's just like, this is a film that is very small, and yet it is much greater than it initially seems to be. Some of the actual narrative elements of the film itself. But in that regard, like, One from the Heart is a film that could be told very simply, and it ends up being puffed up and grandiose. This is a film that always stays pretty small, but in its unfolding, it seems to become much larger than it is.
Yeah, no, this is a film that, when you say thematically rich, this is a prime example of what we mean when we say that. This is a film where there are layers and layers of text and subtext that can be pulled out of this film. And it's all in dialogue with itself, so it's never something you can sort of pull apart without talking about other components of it at the same time, which makes it, you know, very hard. I don't want to say hard to digest, but it makes it something that isn't easily... you can be easily sort of summed up in a single single conversation or even a single viewing of the film. It is something you really need to work with, which will probably give you a good indication as to whether this is the film for you, if you're up for that kind of that type of cinema that really does necessitate work on the part of the audience to fully encompass what's going on.
I think that's a good way to put it. This film offers enough to work with, but it's never the kind of film that steers to an easy answer. Different people may have different takes on it. I mean, this is the take of two white Canadian dudes over age 30, you know, just hanging out and talking about it on a podcast. So,
yeah.
You know, we recognize that we probably aren't the experts to talk about a detailed history of Latin America, a detailed history on screen or artistic depictions of homosexuality. But bear with us, folks, because we're going to try and be as objective and non-ignorant as possible.
Yeah, so, and I would also
with all
say
those that... qualifiers.
Yeah, I would just offer one final one also. That, I mean, when we say homosexuality, in terms of the way the film presents it, or is sort of, you know, the social discourse of the time in which the film's produced, that's the way it looks at it. I would say in 2018, and the way in which language has changed and theoretical conceptions have changed, I would say, and social attitudes have changed, certainly I would say that the transgender issues is more probably closer to the heart to what's going on with this film. at the end of the day.
And that's a very good point, Dave, because I think if you simply regard this as sort of as a film concerning homosexuality, I feel like that actually loses some of the thematic richness, because watching this once on this last time around made me realize that I used to think it's a film about two or three core themes, but this time I realized that I think all those themes may actually be linked to one another.
Oh, okay.
So I guess without further ado, shall we dive in?
Yes. So shall we provide a very quick plot summary of this film?
I think we already have. Two people in a jail cell.
Yeah. We should give the forewarning. Spoilers ahead, folks. Because we pretty much have to get into them.
A film like this, I mean, there's no way you can sort of separate it from what happens in it. So, yeah. I guess let me begin by asking you, David, though, and I sort of just tipped my hand there, but if you had to pick a dominant theme, because you're right, this is a film that, aside from maybe a handful of scenes outside of it, it takes place almost exclusively within one prison cell consisting of two people talking. So, in spite of all of that, what would you say the main theme of this film is?
And that's the tricky part, because I think the most explicit and most intriguing side of it is, I would say, again, in a very reductive sense, this is a film between political engagement and escapism. And I think when you say it in those terms, though, you're the initial thing that a listener or viewer of the film might think is that, oh, okay, this is a film that sort of is a lambasting of escapism, and again, when we say that, again, you know, trying to escape real life problems, trying to avoid what's going on in real life as, you know, explicitly a bad thing. And this is going to be sort of a diatribe about, no, you need to be engaged, you need to put things aside. And that's not really the film at all when you get right down to it. It deals with, it's dealing with people and how they deal with the situations they are given. In this case, and it, I would say the film, in terms of how it's structured and how it navigates that theme, is really built around tearing down the boundaries between the notions of escapism and engagement, eliminating that sort of, that sort of arbitrary binary opposition that doesn't really, it's never really held up, but certainly by the end of this movie, I don't think is held up. And of course, because again, of how, as you noted, Andrew, how things are sort of all tied together, that's part and parcel of a large number of other themes and subjects in which we seem to have boundaries which are revealed as porous over the course of this,
or at least somewhat morphable. But I think you're right. I mean, the initial sort of quirk of the film that makes you recognize that something larger is going on is, in the course of like that opening sequence, the two characters, before they're even identified, you know, it sets it up really efficiently, because we have no context for where they are, why they're there. All we know is that one character is talking at length in very flowery prose and moving across the cell, describing a film that they saw a long time ago about, you know, a beautiful woman in trouble. And the other prisoner, seen very little on camera, is almost totally immobile and only piping in to basically keep the plot description on track. So right away, this film shows that it's a dialogue between opposites, but also it sort of lets us, read a bit more broadly about who these characters are as people. So the one describing the film is Louis Molina, who's played by William Hurt, for which Hurt won Best Actor Oscar, back when that actually kind of meant something. And the other prisoner, the one with no time for flights of fantasy, is Valentin, played by Raul Julia. So we come to learn that they're both in a, they're just sharing a jail cell somewhere in Latin America. Molina is currently incarcerated for, It's talked about a few times with different degrees of implication, but I think the actual charge is corrupting a minor.
Yeah. Which, yeah, that's something I think we'll put a peg in that part of it for now, only because it's something that really deserves...
I feel like we'll definitely be returning to this.
Yeah.
So, Valentin, on the other hand, is... Is he a journalist?
He, in the film, I don't think it's the case in the novel, because they give him a little bit of a... They don't, at least so far from what I've read, he is, in the novel, he is far more of a political activist outright. But in the case of the film, he is a journalist who basically, despite, you know, as we come to discover, took a political action in order to help basically a revolutionary leader, Dr. Americano, as he's referred to, flee the country. And in doing so, he is caught by the I guess more or less secret police or police force of this unnamed country, and is now being held as a political prisoner.
I mean, from this, we rapidly learn where these two characters' values are. And that's in the, certainly in the first half of the film, the tension really seems to be Valentin constantly saying, stop talking about the movie, Melina. What does fantasy and escapism, like, what value is that? I mean, Valentin right now is a prisoner of taking direct action. For him, everything is necessarily political. They live in revolutionary times, and to Valentin, he can't sit on the sidelines. But how does Melina see the idea of political engagement?
She basically chooses disengagement. For her, she's not interested in politics. As she puts it, you know, they either bore her or, you know, trouble her, and she doesn't want to deal with that. She would rather, you know, her concerns are, you know, she wants to find, as is phrased repeatedly throughout the film, a real man. There's that concern with romance. There's that concern about, you know, and when she is troubled by something in real life, it's usually about the health of her mother, who, you know, has basically nobody to look after her at this point with Melina in prison. So, you know, as Melina does put it at one point in the film, you know, given the terrible circumstances, you know, she has found herself in, she will escape any way she can, and chooses to do so through, you know, fond remembrances of films that they've seen, and getting wrapped up in sort of the details of everything, and sort of, you know, the dresses, the way people are, you know, the wealth, the sort of the maison scene, really. I mean, is one of the things that you find throughout this film that she really becomes focused on, which is very interesting when you consider that, you know, she's somebody, you know, occupied with wealth, occupied by all these things, while Valentin, you know, is a Marxist revolutionary, we should note. It's not just the revolution, but there is very much a Marxist bent to the movement he is part of. Of course, as we come to discover, you know, Melina is a bit more complicit in things than she's either willing to admit to herself or to Valentin, because she is basically acting as a spy for the prison, for the police, and for the prison warden, trying to get details from Valentin about his group, so that in exchange for hopefully getting parole.
Well, yeah, this is a film where there's there are a couple narrative dodges, I would say. Yeah. First, I would say that's probably the hinge, because the reveal of Melina effectively being a spy happens almost exactly halfway through the film. But in the first section, the first real sense that we get that things might not be as we initially read them comes when Melina's describing the film. And this appears because as she's talking about it, it's acted out on screen, and it leads to a moment of really interesting dramatic irony, because Melina's describing, like, the fashion and this woman in trouble going to an ornate ball. And then, all of a sudden, on screen, we see a bunch of pretty crude anti-Semitic caricatures that Melina, in her summation of the film, doesn't address. And it's Valentin who picks up on that. And then through Valentine, we realized that this beautiful film with the ornate composition and like all these images of luxury, it's not just any spy thriller. It is a Nazi propaganda film.
Yeah. Which, is one of the major details. And this is a critical change from the original source material, I should note. Because in the context of the original novel, there are several films that basically make up part of the conversations between Melina and Valentine throughout the book. And one of them is the Nazi propaganda film, but it's not the entire book. Like, for example, the actual novel opens with Melina describing the plot of Cat People, the old Valuten film, which is very obvious for those who've seen the movie. And it, you know, serves as a very great insight into the two characters, because you have, you know, issues of who does Melina identify with versus Valentine, and basically him providing sort of psychoanalytics of the sexual politics of that film versus what Melina is choosing to see in it. And over the course of the film, obviously, A, they can't just reference Cat People for legal reasons. So that one's out the window. But what they choose to do instead is chop up the Nazi film that Melina describes and expand it pretty much throughout almost the entirety of the movie, in this case, because we only get really two films described over the course of it. It's part of the changes made to sort of make the film a bit more structurally stable, and probably is a very wise choice in the grand scheme of things.
And thematically, it unifies the film really effectively, I think, because this is sort of... What I like about it is that it establishes the theme, fantasy versus reality, but also with that, it shows that there are a number of fundamental misreadings that happen in this film. And so the first major instance is that Melina misreads what this film actually is.
Yeah.
And so this prompts another discussion about whether or not Melina is wrong to just passively enjoy this. Because we need to remember that even though I think most people who will study art will tell you there's no escaping ideology, there's no such thing as a purely objective work.
Yeah.
But at the same time, does that mean commercial entertainment, for instance, is... Are we being morally incorrect or doing something wrong if I look at, if I watch Tout va bien by Godard, if I watch that film and I just appreciate its composition without thinking about its politics, am I doing something wrong? Am I doing something ignorant? Or am I doing something that is complicit or actively destructive to the values of progressivism? And this becomes... one of the debates, and Valentine drops some hard truths on Melina about basically linking to the idea there are many famous phrasings of talking about the Holocaust in terms of many people weren't paying attention, and when they finally came for you, there wasn't anybody else around to object. And like Melina explicitly talks about, or Valentine explicitly talks about how, while you're busy looking at these pretty pictures, you know, the people making them are rounding up their enemies and killing them. And so sometimes you really can't take a back side. You can't sit on the sidelines. But this is also, that would almost be too pat now, wouldn't it? Because then the film ends with Melina learning a very valuable lesson, and Valentine, spreads the good word of the revolution. What happens after that, though, is we have some more conversations, and we realize that Valentine isn't quite as authoritative either.
Yeah, I mean, as we sort of come to learn, I mean, much of his... And this might be unfair in terms of the phrasing I'm putting it, but a lot of his sort of revolutionary speak is kind of performative, as we sort of come to discover, in seeing that this is somebody who has many questions about, you know, what he's done and how he's gotten here and whether it's really been worth it all over the course of this, number one. And again, on top of that, this is all tied into his very narrow and, again, to use a 2018 phrase that I don't think, I'm pretty sure wasn't around in 1985, toxic masculinity, but this becomes bound up with it because it's not just, you know, enough to be a, you know, a revolutionary in his terms. You know, being a revolutionary means, you know, total commitment, and that being total commitment is, you know, being a man, as it were. And that means, you know, putting, you know, frivolous things aside and, you know, putting emotions aside, putting sentiment aside. And yeah, as we come to
the, he's a very stoic character in the early goings.
Yeah.
And to the point where that's something that Melina actively interrogates. There's that one conversation they have where Valentine's talking about his values and how, you know, the goal is to fight back against power. That's what he believes in while refusing the offer of food. And then Melina has that great line of, well, what good are your values and beliefs if they don't allow you to eat an avocado?
Yeah, exactly.
But there's one of those moments, though, where the dynamic then suddenly becomes reversed, because in a certain way, the film begins with Melina talking about the sights from the film and trying to escape into that, whereas Valentine is very grounded, very practical, saying that is not going to help you. But then when Valentine starts talking about the revolutionary ideals and how he needs to be strong, he can't falter, because then they'll discover his revolutionary cell and the people he's close to, and that means he can't acknowledge his love for them. Melina is the one who is very grounded and very practical, saying, well, okay, it's great to have all these big ideas, but right now you need to eat or you're going to die. And so there's that misreading, and then there's another dodge that happens.
Yeah, and it's a part and parcel of the film sort of... transference is a poor choice of word there, but certainly the evolution of these characters and the trajectory they're on ends up, you know, the lines get very blurred in terms of, you know, what is practical versus what is and what's important versus what's supposedly frivolous and unimportant. And the film comes to some very non-conclusive conclusions on those in terms of where it suggests, you know, the relevance of, you know, escapism versus engagement is. And certainly it becomes notable throughout the film that as much as Valentin rejects these films and rejects Melina's telling of them, he also prompts her at various points to engage it. And I mean, he tries to play it off as, you know, it helps pass the time. But there is a clear sense that, you know, he is getting something out of us. There is something there that is, if nothing else, sustaining or at least distracting from the reality that he isn't able to cope with.
Well, yeah, because especially in that first scene, you get the sense that Melina is talking about the film because that's the only way that she can really cope. And then time goes by, the film and the story of the film ends up becoming what these two characters bond over. And I guess, like, maybe at this point we should probably clarify. So, as we've acknowledged, Melina is played by William Hurt, who is a male actor. And this is another of the film's misdirections. And I think what we were saying earlier about viewing this film in the lens of trans identities. And not just trans in the capital T sense, but the idea of transitive identities, where, as Melina says, Melina does not regard herself as a male. And, you know, so in the film, there's a lot of pejorative language about Melina. And I mean, some of that is problematic in a depiction sense, but to Melina, she identifies as a woman. And that's something that Valentine has a lot of difficulty coming to grips with.
Yes. Yeah, and this is very much tied up again with that sense of toxic masculinity and his idea that, no, you have to accept reality for what it is. And, this leads to a, you know, pretty disturbing scene in which he pretty much very cruelly chews Melina out and, you know, basically, you know, opens up her legs and starts saying, you know, you're not a, more or less boils down to, you're not a woman, you're a man, take a look. To which Melina has a really great line, which, you know, particularly in 2018, I think is resonant. It's, that was a mistake there. I mean,
well, yeah, it's for 1985. Like this isn't necessarily coming soon to the multiplex near you, but There are a couple lines that seem very, very forward-thinking, just in terms of addressing the performativity of bodies. So I would say that becomes another sort of unit of this film, the two characters debating gender and masculinity. And I feel like it flows pretty naturally out of the conversation about idealism and fantasy. Because Valentine, especially talking about the revolution and sort of the traits one needs to have, these are all like classically male traits. You must be strong in that. And so, in a sense, it feels like Valentine is using Melina as a counterpoint that he can sort of affirm his own revolutionary credentials. But instead, the moment that he starts asserting this, this is where the film gets really interesting because Melina becomes very Socratic about it, and she starts interrogating all of these statements. And I think it begins with the one question that, sad to say, in 2018, I think a lot of people still need to ask, where he dismisses her fantasy and escapism as, oh, just like a woman. Then Melina says, well, what's wrong with being like a woman? And
No, sorry, didn't mean to cut you
go
off there.
on.
No, I didn't have anything to add. I was just chiming in there, so.
But in doing so, talking about, the idea that, yeah, there's nothing essential to our bodies that determines how we see ourselves as. And the whole idea that these are socially constructed things, and the only reason we view femininity as necessarily negative is because culture's constructed it that way. And there are a number of lines in the film as well that kind of play off of this sort of rigidity. There's that line later on, which I've marked down here, which is, your tears are proof that you have the feelings of a man. And in statements like that, we sort of see these ideas colliding in the same sentence with one another. And again, like as with fantasy and reality, we see that they're paired as opposites. But under interrogation, the binary of these things break down a little bit, and then we suddenly realize there's a much larger site of interchange in the middle. And granted, the film does not handle this necessarily in a perfect way. This is not a film being made by queer theorists or like as part of an overly queer political film project. And I think that is why this film is so fascinating to me. Because all right, let's I think before we can move on, we have to address the big elephant with this film, which is how though is Melina portrayed? Because I think it would be a bit of a stretch to say that Melina is a totally progressive figure in how she's presented.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain things that certainly, if this film came out today, would be very rightfully called upon, and probably should have been in 1985 as well. I don't know whether they were or not. But first of all, is the fact that, this is, William Hurt, who, by every conversation I've ever heard, is a straight male actor playing a trans character, which, again, is a tradition Hollywood still engages in, and was certainly much more controversial with Eddie Redmayne a few, was it 2 years ago? When he was up for an Oscar, and I think may have won as
For
well.
Theory of Everything,
I th was theory of, was that his, no, I th wasn't Theory of
he
Everything
won
his.
for that.
Okay, maybe it is Theory. I'm honestly, I'm getting it mixed up in my head because there was also the other film he did where he played Stephen Hawking.
Yes,
It
that one
didn't.
is Theory of Everything, and he did win the Oscar for that.
Yeah, okay, yeah. No, there's another film he was at least nominated for, I'm pretty sure, after that, where he played a transgender character, and a lot of questions, well, why was, a straight male actor cast into this role? Could a transgender actor not have been actually employed in this role? Which, again, fair credit, that should have been the case. Likewise, and this is something we sort of, in our notes, had to address, is the question of, I don't think Melina is meant to be an American character, and there's nothing in the text that suggests that she is, except for the fact that William Hurt is playing the character.
Yeah, and that is tough because if I feel like if you view Melina as an American character versus not saying that one reading of the film is better or more nuanced,
Yeah.
but Melina being an American, especially that Melina is the one who wants to be ignorant of politics, as an American that has a different set of themes that are raised.
Yeah, but it certainly does end up raising questions about, at the very least, the whitewashing of the character, because I think there's nothing in either the novel I've read thus far, and certainly nothing in terms of what we see on screen that suggests we should be reading Melina as anything other than as somebody of the country that she's in. Having said that, now, the big question, though, of course, and the real problematic element of Melina is, again, why is she in jail in the first place? And again, as we sort of noted earlier, the character is listed as having been involved with corrupting a minor. And as we discover from other dialogue, including a point where the warden, as Melina is being paroled, saying, you know, stay away from the, well, it was little boys is the way he phrases
yeah,
it.
Yeah, stay away from the younger kind. It's strongly implied that, yes, Melina had sexual relations with a minor.
Which...
And despite what, you know, William Burroughs and Paul Bowles and all that gang say, that's still a crime, and that's kind of hard to get past.
Well, it's hard to get past it. I mean, I certainly, you know, here in 2018, after the latter half of 2017, this is something that's very much prominent here, and I think relates to... The thing is, you can read it one of three ways, I say. If you're being generous, you can sit there and say that what they're suggesting is, you know, that this is coded language for criminalizing what they view as homosexuality, which... That's being very generous.
Because I think the first time I watched this film, I saw it in that sense where they're saying the charge is corrupting a minor, but they mean it in a more metaphoric register. The idea that, well, Melina, people like you and your crazy ideas will lead our children astray. But watching it this time and noticing those two lines, I'm like, yeah, no, there's definitely a literal element as well.
Yeah, and I think it's backed up by the
problematic.
Fact, yeah, and it's backed up by the fact that, again, we see that there is a lot wider community outside of this prison that doesn't seem to be, at least as shown, I mean, it seems to be very out in the open and isn't, you know, it doesn't, at least for what we're showing, it doesn't seem to be people, you know, under a repression to the point where there isn't things such as the club that they attend and other areas. But... Having said that, I mean, obviously, our then second reading is that, you know, we take it completely for what that statement means, in which case Melina is a predatory figure, and the film never addresses that if that's the case. And that, you know, really, really makes it a challenging problem at that point, because I don't think you could just sweep that under the rug. And then possibly a third reading, which ties in with our second, is the film is now making associations between notions of homosexuality and pedophilia.
Yeah, in case Sleepaway Camp was too subtle for the home viewer, you know?
Well, I mean, you have that, yeah. And I mean, particularly, especially, and again, very much in light of 2017 and the Kevin Spacey situation that arose when he tried to deflect the claims of him being a predator by coming out, and it's like you're reinforcing stereotypes that have no basis in reality here. And
well, yeah,
deeply problematic at that point, to say the least.
Kind of get a lid on this can of worms before we just rip the whole top off. Let's just say that I agree with you, Dave. Though we're okay. It would be one thing if the film or the novel unpacked this in any way or got any sense of perspective, you know, sort of like what led Melina through those moments. But it happens off screen. It's not discussed in any sustained or meaningful way. It's just sort of there. And this only becomes a problem because in the final, say, the final half hour of the film, I guess for those keeping track how the plot's working, in the final passage of the film, Melina is released from the prison and goes back into the outside world and sort of has to face the choice, do I return to the life that I was living, or do I give Valentine one last favor and contact his comrades? The thing is, we're supposed to identify with Melina and sort of feel in the emotional register as we see her struggle with this choice. And, you know, I feel like what the film wants to do is draw a parallel between, who is she in the film within the film? Is that Lenny, Sonia Braga's character?
Yeah, I believe Lenny is the character she plays there. She also plays Marta, which is Valentin's lost love that he sort of gave up when he committed to his revolutionary ideals. And the titular Spider Woman, which we haven't even addressed. That's another thing I guess we'll get to in a little bit. But
well, we were right. This film has a lot to unpack. But yeah, so I feel like in that final bit, I'm pretty sure it's not just, you know, offhandedly, but I feel like there's a strong relation drawn between the characters of Lenny and Melina. Because the main plot of the film within the film is, yes, a young woman gets sort of seduced by revolutionaries and has to make the choice between, you know, the man she loves and the country that she must serve. And it's sort of, Melina finds herself in a very similar situation. But the moment that you go from, well, Melina's a passive figure. She didn't ask for any of this, but now has to make a choice, versus, well, Melina's not really a passive figure because Melina's a predatory character who has agency in certain matters. It causes us to build a very different chain of identifiers and consequently have a very different emotional response to the end of the film.
Yeah, and it really makes it tough in a way that I certainly don't think anybody involved intended or probably even realized at the time they made it. Because certainly, I will say this film packs a punch 33 years on. Like, this thing is still, it is emotionally devastating in many ways. And it is a very thoughtful, unique, and I would say, you know, to not to spoil our entire conversation, but worth seeing. But that, you know, even though it's such a small component in terms of its presence in the film, it really does make it far more troubling and much less clear than it should be, in a way. And I'm all for problematic, but this is not the way, I'm not for problematic, but I'm all for complicated when it's handled correctly. But this isn't it.
Well, yeah, so effectively, it's like, do we want to see Melina as Lenny, and bear with me because I just figured this out and I think I'm brilliant, or do we read Melina as the Spider-Woman?
Yeah, the Spider-Woman, I guess, in the case of the film, this is the second film Melina explains, which ends up being this weird, again, as it parallels what's going on in the main story of the movie itself. You know, this, you know, woman who is entrapped in her own web. And how exactly does the tale itself go again, Andrew? I know there's like the washed up, you know, injured individual that she has to take care of.
Yeah, I think it's very brief and it's pretty abstract, but I'm pretty sure that, yeah, a sailor basically washes up on the beach and, when it comes to, looks up, and there is this enormous, ornate Spider Woman shedding a tear over him.
Yeah, and it's one of these things where, again, I get thematically why this is there. Again, it's sort of this character who brings about their own downfall, trapped in their own web that they've almost built up around them. But it's also one of those things where, why did you name the story after this? I mean, it's a great title, but it's also one where, again, and I not to be, you know, nitpick on this, but you say that title to somebody, they think, oh, it's a science fiction B-movie. It's like, no, that's not what we're talking about with this movie. It's anything but that. And
that's another misreading, in a sense, that you're right. Like, it's such an evocative title when you hear Kiss of the Spider-Woman. Like, that conveys a lot, like, even a very noirish kind of vibe. But this film, like, This film never really congeals into what you think it's going to be. And going over the notes here, you even make mention of the trailer of the film presents it as very different than the film that we're actually getting on screen.
Yeah, I mean the trailer that's included on the TV sells this thing, and presumably was the only theatrical trailer in '85. Sells it like it's this, thriller. They're particularly focusing on sort of the climax of the movie, as it were, and sort of the heated exchanges between Valentin and Melina. But it makes it look like it's like this prison drama where they're going head to head, where everything's heated and everybody's yelling and it's all sorts of action, and that's not the film. But I on one hand, it's kind of hard for me to blame them for trying to sell it like that, because how do you sell this movie? I mean, because ostensibly it's not, it is a prison drama about the relationship of two characters, but it's not quite a conventional romance in any typical sense.
Yeah, and even to say prison drama, like that suggests there's a plot emphasis that isn't really present in this film. It's yeah, like honestly, it is, as we keep coming back to, it's a film about two people talking, but not in the same way that My Dinner with Andre is a film about two people talking. And not just because Wallace Shawn isn't here, but it's just like that's the thing though, because all these misreads and misdirections, some of them weren't purely up to the filmmakers. And yet every time it happens, it seems to reflect, I think, the film, one of the film's major points, which is that, yeah, I mean, you can never assume what you know something is from the outset. So linking that theme together, we have Valentin dismissing Melina as a homosexual and not realizing that no, Melina is a woman. She just happens to have a body unlike most women. There's the film that's misunderstood and not being seen in terms of a propaganda film. There's sort of I think there you can argue Melina's choices in the final act are a kind of misreading as well. There's the title of the film. There's the trailer as it's presented. There's, yeah, I mean, there's all that going on. I think I would like to ask you, though, about the idea of binaries in this film. And sort of as we've alluded to in the dialogue, it's not that the film really stakes a position as much as it seems interested with interrogating binarisms in general. And, here's where it's difficult to talk about this film because every point raised in sort of the political register ends up flowing into the personal, the body politics register. So it can be kind of difficult to keep this streamlined. But okay, near the end of the film, before Melina is released, there are two important things that happen. One of them is that Melina realizes that she is actually falling in love with Valentin. And more importantly, Valentin is starting to realize that he's falling in love with Melina. So the two have that moment where they consummate. And then there is a line that I think is absolutely crucial to the film. Where did I write it down? Yes, Melina's talking about how she felt and what her experience was and says, "I felt like I wasn't me. I was you." This, I think, is so important because throughout the early part of the film, Melina keeps basically pantomiming everything Lenny does in the film as she's describing the plot of it. And I feel like after this moment, Melina is released, and that builds up to the moment where she makes her choice. But when she does that, I feel like going back to this line, it's not Melina anymore, it's Melina's performance of Valentine who makes the choice. Does that make sense, or am I just getting really abstract?
No, I think you're onto something. I'm not sure. I guess it does beg the question as to what, how much Melina has changed. I mean, she does go into this effectively knowing she's going to her death, because again, we end up seeing her take out all her money to ensure that it's going to be going forward to her mother to make sure that she's looked after, along these lines. But at the same time, it's, I would say there's two things about this, so to sort of back it up. I would say it's, if it is performative, it's still a, it's not quite Melina trying to be Valentin. If it almost, so much as it is Melina taking on Valentin's last bit of advice, which is, you know, don't let anybody, what is it? Don't let anybody degrade you. If I'm wrong.
Yeah. Never let anyone just degrade you. Never let anyone exploit you.
Yeah.
And because that's going back to the first conversation between the two, you know, Valentin, his outrage comes from the fact that people in the seat of power will just use it to marginalize everyone around them.
Yeah.
And sort of part of the connection they form is Valentin realizing that Melina understands what it's like to be marginalized and exploited by the center, though in a very different context than Valentin himself understands it. They realize they do know what it's like to be marginalized by power.
Well, absolutely. And I think the key thing here is, I mean, there is, that's certainly going on. I would also say what makes it more complicated to me is that I kind of read the way events play a little bit differently, I think, than you did. Because I certainly do believe.
All right, let's walk it back for a second and just say what those events are. So the film concludes with Valentin still in prison, Melina goes back in the community, hangs out at one of the local bars. You get the sense of detachment. And eventually, Melina agrees to make the phone call and meet with the revolutionaries. She seems to realize that she's being followed by the secret police. A shootout ensues. Melina is fatally wounded. The police interrogate her to give them the names of the contacts, to give the phone number, and then dropping some more slurs against her. Melina just looks at them, doesn't say a word, and then dies in the back of a police car.
Yeah.
And then what happens after that with Valentin?
Having apparently been once again interrogated with what we would say in the parlance of the George W. Bush administration, enhanced interrogation tactics. Valentin is in the prison hospital where, I'm not sure whether it's a nurse or a doctor, but one of them has secretly given him morphine in order to help him cope with the pain. And
yeah, it's so bad what they've done to him that he's basically said, I recognize that they're going to fire me if I do this, but I am going to help you. So he has been brutally, brutally beaten.
Yeah, and he drifts off into a dream which starts with him, Marta, Valentin's lost love, who wanted him to stay out of the revolutionary material, in which he still pines for, coming to get him, getting him out of prison, and then sort of, it seems at first, going into the way in which it's shot with the sort of blue filter and look to it, what looks like the Spider-Woman beach sequence that we sort of see from Melina's point of view, before they row off in a boat together, you know, as the credits roll and everything comes into color, and basically, you know, Valentin's escaped into fantasy as his way of coping with the reality he now finds himself in. Which again sort of completes that sense of transition and transference that goes on with these characters in both cases. The thing about it, though, I think that's interesting is, and to sort of back it up to one of your points, the idea that of Melina being in love with Valentin and Valentin being in love with Melina. I agree with you that Melina has fallen in love with Valentin. I'm not 100% sure that it's the case of Valentin having fallen in love with her, so much as
you avoided the trap there.
Yeah, it seems to me it's more complicated than that. I mean, you get the sense that Valentin, what the actions, the consummation, as you refer to, is something that is more. Again, because one of the things we haven't referenced is that throughout a good chunk of this movie, Valentin has been poisoned with the food as part of a way to sort of weaken him up in order to get him to start talking about the revolution and the groups and the people he's involved with. And Melina takes care of him throughout this and eventually, you know, sort of tries to help him keep away from the poison food by cleverly getting enough food that he can eat and get well on his own there. And part of it, again, this ends up softening him up where he realizes, you know, he has been somebody who, as you're talking about marginalization and abuse, has been abusive towards Melina himself. Melina on his own part as well. And sort of begins to recognize his own failings, you know, and how his sort of conception of masculinity and femininity isn't quite as clear cut. And certainly the idea of being sensitive isn't quite as clear cut as he once thought it was, which I think also ties in nicely because I don't think this film presents a particularly flattering perspective on the revolutionaries either, because Melina's killed from a bullet from them. And it's not an accidental one. They straight up shoot her in the stomach.
Yeah, it seems that they assume that once the meeting goes south that they must have been tipped off by Melina. So Melina ends up, dying in a public square with everybody mad at her. I guess a question, though, coming back to the difficulty of resolution, though, that final Valentine's sort of dream sequence, for lack of a better term, there's a lot going on in there, and I feel like there's just enough going on that it doesn't resolve neatly either, because his, whether it's escapism, whether it's a death fantasy, whatever, it's him there with his original love, who, you know, sort of, he gets this happy completion with someone that we have every reason to believe is a female. And that almost makes me more inclined to see that the Spider-Woman is Melina.
Yeah.
And in that sense, when we think about Melina, there is one kiss of the Spider-Woman. Do you know when that happens in the film?
Right before they, if I remember the order of the sequence correctly, right before she leaves the prison.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of the moment where everything gets locked on course. And that's the problem, though, because I don't think this is a film that's encouraging us to read Melina as a purely destructive influence or necessarily use language like the Spider-Woman, because in some respects, a big part of the emotional arc of the film is Melina kind of learning her own agency. But at the same time, there are so many problems with her as a character. But then you turn around and say, well, William Hurt is obviously effeminizing himself in this role, but especially in terms of dialogue, William Hurt has a pretty deep voice in any other role. And he doesn't artificially pitch up. He doesn't speak in a falsetto. There are some areas where, the classical on-screen codification of homosexuality is absent. So, how do we make sense of this, David? I've seen this film a whole bunch. I'm fascinated by it, and I still don't honestly know what the film is trying to lead us to think. Because the same way that Melina engages in the revolution and ends up dead, and then Valentine may learn that, there are benefits to escapism, but none of them are going to benefit him. It's not going to change the situation. So is this film supposed to make us realize, everything just collapses into the same and we all die anyway? What do you think this film is really trying to say?
And that's the thing, because I don't know if I have a simple answer to this. I mean, I don't, and I'm not entirely sure that the film wants to give us a definitive answer on any of this. It could be as simple as everything is situational or contextual. Could be the case. I mean, it's one of these instances that, there are, clearly there are problems with escapism. There are times when it is necessary. And likewise, there are times when it is important to be politically active and engaged. But, I mean, whether it's an instance of these things need to coexist and are working in tandem and should be working in tandem, or whether it's ultimately, survival by any means necessary, I honestly don't, I can't really put my finger on it in any easy way. And in many ways, I appreciate about that film. This is one of the things I really do like about this movie is you can't easily, you know, wrap it up and, you know, here's, you know, the very linear, you know, prescriptive essay that describes exactly what this film's about and exactly what you need to take away from it. It just leaves the viewer with many heavy questions that aren't going to ever be comfortably resolved, as you've noted here.
But see, unlike One from the Heart, though, I feel like being left with that feeling of, wait, what? I feel like that's more deliberate, because this is a film that it's... the mechanism that moves it along is Socratic questioning of essentials and absolutes. And so I guess I feel like the only way that this film could have betrayed itself in the ending is all of a sudden being like, nope, here's an essentialized definition of what the right thing to do is, or, you know, the right way to be a man, or be politically aware, or any of that. I think one of the key lines in sort of reading that, it's one of the last lines in the film where Valentine in his dream sequence says something to the effect of, I was having a dream. It was a short dream, but I was happy.
Yeah.
And I feel like, yeah, maybe that's the best you can hope with. Everything is just dreams upon dreams, but, you know, you hang on to the pleasures that they offer whenever they arrive. But speaking of arriving at places, I realize we have gone quite a bit, we've run quite a bit of time on trying to detail this film, and it's so weird because, once again, all this analysis and we're left with throwing our hands up and saying, I don't know.
Well, and I think... No, I was just going to say, I think if anything, though, that ends up, I mean, it's the case where, as much as we may try and intellectualize it and analyze it and provide a sense of this movie, it is something ultimately the viewer, hopefully you listeners out there, are going to have to engage with and come away with on your own, because, you know, I would highly recommend this movie, but what you're going to get out of it, at the end of the day, is that's entirely what you bring to it and what you want to get out of it, really.
And I think maybe that almost is kind of what keeps this film from having sort of a larger legacy. The fact that, yeah, I mean, depending on who's watching it, there are aspects of it that are incredibly problematic, incredibly progressive, some aspects that are very beautiful and idealistic, and some that are crushingly cynical. And the fact that it remains open to all of them, even as a finished object, you know, it's great as a talking point, but, you know, filmmaking is a business, and sometimes you can't have too much ambiguity if you're trying to sell something to a larger audience. But no, I agree with you there, David. This is one of those films that, you know, you really need to just watch, because there's so much more to this film that we won't even have time to get into. And it's a fascinating conversation piece. But this is one web that you will find great difficulty untangling yourself from.
But
so shall we wrap up with bringing back our second version of the recap segment that you all know and love, Four Hits, Four Pits?
Yep, sure, why not? So
now I'm thinking, because last week we don't want to repeat too many of the major broad stroke summaries of the film. So I'm wondering, maybe this time we'll think a bit smaller. What are like two more discrete things that you really enjoyed about this film?
Okay. Do you want me to start off?
Go ahead.
All right. One thing that we haven't really described, but is certainly might be worth paying attention to, but I like, is the score, or more notably, its frequent absence before it really sort of kicks in during the last third of the movie, which I really enjoyed. I think it is very memorable and very... it's 80s in the best way possible. I will say this. It's this weird mesh of almost classically orchestral early on and becoming more of this... I want to say almost electronic thriller-ish as we head into the final stretch of the film. two away. So, I mean, again, it's not the key selling point of this movie. I mean, this is something very strictly focused on the drama. But kudos on the music, I will say. What about you, Andrew?
The music is very distinctive, and I love the title theme quite a bit. And for those keeping score at home, the music is by John Neschling.
Yes.
I think did the composing. I guess from the formal register, I will also take a look. This time I want to focus on the cinematography.
Yes.
The film was shot by someone named Rodolfo Sanchez, who, you know, I'm not going to pretend that I'm well-versed in their work, but considering how limited the film is spatially, the film does a really, really interesting job in terms of composition, because it's the same space, but depending on the framing of different parts of the cell with different conversations, it becomes very easy to forget that this is such a contained area, because, you know, depending on which monologue that Melina is giving in that, you know, sometimes she's shot close by the wall, and every single time that the space is presented differently, you notice new details. It's like, it's an instance where, yeah, very small space, just depending on how you shoot it, can look like a wholly new area, or you can recognize, like, details that you didn't notice prior. It's a very interesting way of making the same familiar locations very distinctive on a scene-by-scene basis.
Yes. So,
and it's one of those things where this is a film that could fall into that horrible category of, like, the filmed play, where, yeah, it could just be two characters shot from the side talking the whole time. But the film does different things than that, and I think it's more interesting for it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess on another sort of hit as well to go with this, and to sort of build off what you're talking about, while you are correct in the cinematography and how it's treated in itself, because that is the sort of central crux of the film and the what they needed to get right. I'm also going to give credit to the film fantasy sequences in terms of their look and staging and this sort of evocation of sort of classic filmmaking, sort of classical filmmaking in terms of composition and lighting. I mean, it engages a bit in that sort of hazy memory filter, which definitely sets it off from the look of actual classic film. But I think a really good job in terms of the period detailing and the staging of these sequences really is effective in these moments. And again, it's not a central part of this film. In fact, from what I understand in the trivia, an early cut of this movie, you know, was overwhelmed with way more of the film fantasy sequences than required and had to be cut down prior to picking up distribution.
Sometimes less is so much more.
Yeah, and I could easily see how this could go awry in a situation like this. But, you know, I think they appear quite, you know, at the right points throughout. I do give them credit for pulling it off, though, so on a technical level, which might be hinting towards one of my pits. But I'll throw it over to you, Andrew, for your last hit.
All right, my last hit is the part where Raul Julia, one of my all-time favorite lines, says, is this propaganda or porno?
Yeah.
No, seriously. I think not enough can be said about the two main performances in the film. Melina's a very problematic character, but that's not an outcome of Hurt's performance. And in fact, I think the strength of the performance is that Hurt plays it so real, like without those classic trappings, like the wink to the audience or any of that stuff. He portrays Melina as a real human being, whereas, you know, she could very easily just lapse into parody. The same way that Valentin certainly begins in the film as a stereotypical kind of Latin American communist revolutionary, but he softens up in the course of the film too. And I think what the film is trying to do as a thematic project only works by virtue of the fact that the two leads in the film are able to do it so well on screen themselves.
Yeah. So, absolutely
Like,
agree.
I mean, this film is carried by those performances. They are what the film is.
Oh,
So,
absolutely, yeah.
just happens to work out well that they got two good ones.
Yeah.
So, speaking of good things and its opposite, what do you have for pits, Dave?
Well, to sort of build off of the exact opposite of what you're talking about, and I feel bad kind of saying this, but Sonia Braga, as a performer, I don't know whether to really blame her or to pin the blame on Babenco's direction, but she just does not work in this movie for me, for the most part. Now, the good news is it's a small, relatively small role. So it's not distracting in the least, and it's not one of the important components of it. But again, one, I don't think anything was really gained by having her in three separate roles throughout the movie. Because it doesn't, I don't think that actually ends up adding too much thematically to this film that makes it worthwhile. But her, even though I understand her performance is supposed to be broad in terms of the way in which Melina is expressing it, it never sits right. It doesn't feel broad on purpose. It feels like, no, she's aiming for something, legitimate and just failing to achieve it. I'm probably doing a very poor job of sort of expressing it, but just every time she's on screen, it never sat quite right with me. And even in her one brief scene as Marta, she doesn't really register enough to really give you a reason to understand why Valentine is still sort of fixated upon her. So
I
I
think the possible answer to that may be that Marta is Valentine's escape.
yeah.
And I mean, it's not an accident that in the film within the film, the Spider-Woman and Marta are all played by the same character. But I mean, you're right in the sense that, it's a very marginal role in the film, and much of what she's doing is sort of being narrativized by Melina anyway. She
Yeah.
doesn't really, the film doesn't give her an opportunity to really stand out beyond just her ability to be looked at.
Yeah. And that's unfortunate. I mean, she does. I mean, I feel bad saying because I really don't think it's fair to judge her performance, given the situation and the context in which it finds out. It's just, I get the feeling that either there was something that she was asked to do that she's not achieving, or Babenco just really didn't know what kind of direction to give her, to let her sort of find a through line throughout this. And it's unfortunate because, I feel at least as far as Marta is concerned, something a bit more, substantial probably should have been found for those scenes. But again, that's neither here nor there. I mean, it's a small quibble within the film itself. But what about you, Andrew? What's your first pit?
I would say I'm actually trying to think, and normally I'm really good at nitpicking. Nothing huge is jumping out, like unless I want to say the film's problematic treatment of homosexuality and transitive identity is a pit, but I'm
Yeah.
like that's not necessarily unique to this film. Now granted that doesn't excuse it either, but
Yeah.
I would say that this film may be a little bit too long.
Okay.
And again, it's hard to say where those cuts need to be made, but I think it's also just because it's a very different kind of film. So 2 hours and 10 minutes of characters talking, it's a very rewarding 2:10, but also let me just say that this is the kind of film that you sort of have to be in the right mindset for, because as you said early, Dave, and I agree wholeheartedly, this is a film that really gets it gives back what you invest into it.
Yeah.
And it is very rewarding, but it's also very frustrating, and it does require, some thought. And this is not the kind of film that you can just disengage from the real world with.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily a bad thing, but take that under advisement if you decide to have your own film strip on this one.
Yeah, this is certainly not what you throw on it. Hey, let's all go have a fun time at the movies. Just, you know.
Exactly. Look, everyone, Gomez is in this.
Yeah. And I'm sure that there are people who probably rented it with that exact mindset going into it. So, yeah. I guess for my final bit, I do have one that does stand out for me, and I was sort of holding off because it's a nitpick, and it could be so much worse, but it doesn't mean that I didn't notice it. The ADR work on 99% of the actors in this film, aside from Raul Julia and William Hurt, because there is some clear... I don't know whether this is a case of the actors themselves were brought back in to dub over their own lines, or whether they were dubbed over by somebody completely different after. But there are points where you get the feeling, you know, the lip sync isn't quite lining up right, and something just feels off. Particularly, like, for example, Melina has the conversation about the waiter that she was infatuated with, but nothing ever happened between them. And it seems whenever he's on screen, I am confident that most of his lines were re-recorded in a booth later on, and it just feels that way. I don't know if you picked up on this at all, Andrew, or if I'm just, you know, really super nitpicking.
I didn't, only because I thought it was just an issue with my laptop and maybe a syncing issue. Yeah. Also because with Melina's voiceovers and sort of summations of the film, like, I guess I was sort of conditioned to see things as a little bit out of sync with one another. But, yeah. But you're right, because even as well just the formal composition of all the scenes outside the prison cell, weirdly enough, end up looking a whole lot more grim, you know, than anything that happens in there. Like, they're less polished, they're less colorful, they're certainly not stylized, and, well, even the ADR seems off.
Yeah.
So it's a film that unknowingly tries to make the argument that being inside a prison cell is better, I guess.
So wait for the Netflix television series adaptation when they expand on that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's deep diving into everyone's backstories. And yeah, five more seasons following the adventures of that waiter. Yeah. Any final things you would like to add, David?
As far as the film, no, I think I've exhausted everything I have to say. I think we've made it pretty clear if what we've said isn't going to engage you, it sounds interesting to you, by all means, check this movie out. If it doesn't sound like your cup of tea, there's probably a good chance it isn't. That's not to discourage you from seeing it, just you listener will know your taste better than we do. But what about you, Andrew?
And I would say that, yeah, in 2018, everywhere you look, you can easily find a debate regarding how complicit we are in the larger political forces that act out in the world. And the idea of, oh, well, it's only a movie, you know, certain things shouldn't matter. Anybody who's gotten into an argument like that recently... Well, it turns out that those same arguments were being made in another film 33 years ago. And, you know, it's not didactic enough to suggest that there's a right answer. But it, I think watching this film helps us realize that these are questions that are ongoing and never really resolved. And the moment that we think we pin it down, that's the only time we know that we've done something a little wrong. So I would say, yeah, go back and watch this film because it is... It's fascinating. I feel like it does a lot of things that just other films don't. Whether you're looking at the formal or the thematic registers, it really does kind of stand on its own. And at the end of the day, you get to see that William Hurt is, he gives a fantastic performance, and you get to see that Raul Julia was so much more than M. Bison. And yeah, so let me just unbuckle myself, Dave, because I think this next stretch of the drive, you've got the wheel.
Yeah, and I was looking at the map. There's a brief moment where I was looking at, you know, sort of veering off on this Leonard Schrader drive down to the Yakuza. But you know what? I kind of like, you know, the road we're on at the moment. So I think we're going to head straight for, you know, with Raul Julia and into Street Fighter from 1994, which...
No way! You honestly did?
Yeah, so we're going for that one, folks. And if you...
Okay.
I feel I'll put it this way. We just did something really heavy. Now mm-hmm. it is time to do the exact opposite of that. We're going to talk about the 1994 action classic Street Fighter from 1994, starring Raul Julia and Jean-Claude Van Damme, and based on the iconic video games. This is going to be
interesting. Oh, this is going to be so much fun. Oh, man. Well, I certainly can't wait. I've filled up my Nalgene and got to make sure I get some Cliff Bars the next stop we have. Sounds like it's going to be a bumpy ride.
Oh, yes.
All right. And hopefully when we get there, hopefully all of you will have remained in the car with us.
Yeah.
And for everyone who bails now, well, I guess we'll see you when we get there.
Yes.
So, until our next stop on the journey, this has been Film Stripped. I'm Andrew Kanegeezer.
I'm Dave Babbitt.
And remember, adventuring might scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Goodbye, folks.